Hello, it's Friday the 25th of June and I'm Jim White, sitting in for the holidaying Andrew Pearce. And this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming direct from the Daily Mail newsroom. Researchers just confirmed that one of the unexpected consequences of contracting COVID could be losing your sense of smell. What can you do if that's happened to you? We'll be finding out. Also, junk food ads will be restricted from our screens from 2023. Will this make us slimmer as a nation? And does it infuriate you when you overhear someone ordering an espresso? Apparently, pronunciation of the English language is high on our list of everyday aggravations. Stay tuned to hear more. First up, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, has confirmed that Malta, Madeira, the Balearic Islands, several UK overseas territories and Caribbean islands, including Barbados, will be added to the government's green list from 4 a.m. on Wednesday, June the 30th. But apart from Malta, these additions will also be placed on the green watch list, as will Israel and Jerusalem, which means these destinations are at risk of being moved at any moment from green to amber. Also, if you plan to head to Eritrea, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Mongolia, Tunisia or Uganda, they've been added to the red list. So what does all this mean for British travellers in the next few weeks? Let's hear from Paul Charles, Chief Executive at the PC Agency, who advises airlines on managing crises and is a former Communications Director at Virgin Atlantic. Paul, does this mean I can buy a ticket to Malta today and not worry about quarantining when I get back?
Pretty well, Jim. Yes, it does. You could buy a ticket and you could obviously fly to that wonderful island. And if you come back after 4 a.m. on Wednesday morning, then you wouldn't have to quarantine. You would still have to take a pre-departure test, of course, and then a test on day two when you're back in the UK. What you've got to look out for, though, is what rules Malta's got in place. And this is the confusing part for many consumers planning to travel who haven't checked what their destination rules are. And in the case of Malta, they've made it very clear they'll only accept fully jabbed British travellers. So if you haven't got 10 days after your second jab in your diary yet, then they won't let you in. So you've got to check on those sorts of things.
Well, you're absolutely right there. There is another element in all this. It's what's happening when you arrive. Is it likely that Angela Merkel will get her way and that British tourists will be obliged to quarantine when they arrive in European Union destinations, even what are now green ones, do you think?
Angela Merkel is certainly on a mission, and I dare say there's perhaps some political motivation in this, not just practical health motivation. But I'm not sure she's going to get her way. The British tourism pound abroad is a huge contributor over the summer to many European economies, especially in the southern Mediterranean. The likes of Greece, they rely on the British tourist. And I don't think they're going to fall into line. And I don't think Italy will, or Portugal, or Spain. I think they will say, well, actually, we're quite happy to let the British in as long as they've been fully jabbed. And that become the norm, I think, for travel into Europe this summer. So she's unlikely to win this battle.
Money talks, in other words, Paul. But when can we see? When can we expect to see the removal of quarantine period for fully vaccinated UK citizens when they return from amber countries at the moment?
It's a really good question. And in fact, the government yesterday just didn't go far enough on this issue. They've leaked it. They've talked about it in advance. They got everybody excited saying it's coming, that, you know, you won't have to quarantine if you come back from an amber country in due course, and then let everybody down last night by saying it'll be later in the summer. Well, that's simply not good enough, I'm afraid. All of the data, including NHS test and trace data at the moment, shows there are no variants being brought into the UK from amber countries. At least all of the testing is showing that. So therefore, there's very little risk. And so the government should be enabling us to travel right now if we've been double jabbed. Over 35 million people have in this country. And there's no reason why they should be held back from going to a safe amber country and not having to quarantine on their way back. The problem is the government's saying late in the summer, and that's simply too late for much of the travel industry.
Now, listen, you advise companies, airline companies, on how to manage crises. In your view, when it comes to travel, how's the government handling this one? that's your answer, is it?
That's my answer. I think it says it all. Shambolically, there's no doubt about it. They're all over the place. Clearly, there are disagreements in cabinet. There's no doubt about it between Matt Hancock and Priti Patel on one side and Grant Shapps and Gavin Williamson on the other. And it's no wonder they spent so long yesterday talking about these things, because there is deep disagreement. And it's been a shambolic policy, especially in terms of how the government has behaved vis-a-vis its relations with other countries. If you look at what they did with Portugal 3 weeks ago, they abandoned it. They took it off the green list at very short notice for very little reason. It should have at least gone onto the green watch list. And so that's a good example of poor communication. And you can add that to many others, especially even yesterday, where the Northern Ireland executive published the details of the English policy 2 hours before the English government did. So I'm afraid the communications all along has been poor, badly managed in terms of communicating with stakeholders in the travel sector, and certainly in terms of relations with other countries.
I don't know why it's your responsibility, Paul, but can you give us something optimistic just to get our teeth into? Do you see any of this changing this summer?
I do. I can be optimistic. Undoubtedly, in August, things will be better because there will be so many more UK citizens double jabbed. And clearly, the vaccine works. The Prime Minister has told us that. And it is leading to fewer hospitalizations or serious illness, at least. And therefore, once we've got more people jabbed, then there should be an opening up of travel during August. But it's going to be choppy. And that's partly because the government has created a choppy scenario. And I'm pretty confident that there's one thing that will be saved this summer. It'll be ministers' traditional trips to Chianti Shire in Italy. I'm pretty convinced everything will be much better for them to be able to take those sorts of villa holidays.
Now, oh, Paul, you're not saying it's one rule for them and one rule for us, are you? Surely
I wouldn't
not.
Ever suggest such a thing. Of course not. Mention UEFA Euro finals. Of course not.
My thanks to Paul Charles there, the chief executive of the PC agency. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Research from the NHS has found that 1 in 3 children leaving primary school are overweight or obese, as are almost 2/3 of adults in England. And there may be a reason for that. Data from 2019 suggests that almost half of all food ads shown on ITV Channel 4, Channel 5 and Sky 1 were for products high in fat, sugar and salt. And that figure rises to nearly 60% between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. Meanwhile, it's been estimated that children under 16 were exposed to 15 billion junk food ads online in 2019, compared to an estimated 700 million just 2 years earlier. Now, new restrictions are coming in from 2023, meaning that ads for junk food and confectionery cannot appear on screens before 9 p.m. So with me to discuss the implications of all this is Caroline Kearney from the Obesity Health Alliance. Now, Caroline, what is the psychological impact of junk food advertising, do you feel?
Well, there's really good evidence to show that advertising works to influence the choices that we make on a number of different levels. So we know, particularly with children who are a very susceptible audience to advertising, that when they see adverts for food, it makes them want to eat that type of food straight away and also in the longer term. But it also makes them eat more of that type of food as well. So when the majority of adverts that they're seeing are for foods that are, you know, high in fat and high in salt, that becomes a really big problem. And people often say, oh, well, children, you know, they don't control what they eat, you know, it's down to the parents. And that's really not, you know, that's a false argument, because I think for younger children in particular, parents may have control over what they're eating, for sure. But we know as well that these types of advertising lead to things like pest to power. When they're in the supermarket a few days later with their parents, they may be asking for particular types of food. And any parents will know how kind of wearing down pest to power can be. But also for older children, you know, have a lot of autonomy. They're walking to school, you know, to and from school with their friends. They may have some pocket money. And it's, you know, it's quite common for us to see children, you know, coming in and out of shops and, you know, fast food outlets and sort of buying the food that they've seen in adverts, because, you know, children are essentially up to the age of 16 and need protecting from harmful advertising.
Well, health officials reckon that the new restrictions could remove up to 7.2 billion calories from children's diets per year, which over the coming years might reduce the number of obese children by more than 20,000. I mean, can you see it as having as big an impact as that?
I think the policy is designed to work on a number of levels. I mean, there's no one single policy that's going to reduce obesity. You know, we've known that for some time. There are multiple drivers that affect people's weight. Advertising is, you know, is one of them, but it's, you know, it's part of a much bigger picture. So what this policy will do, it will, you know, remove a lot of these adverts, which will really help. But it's also aimed to kind of help shift our food environment, to help shift our food culture, and also to kind of squeeze the food industry. You know, at the moment they're spending a lot of money developing new calorific sugary products, heavily promoting these and heavily advertising these. And once they can't do that, there's going to be less incentive for them to produce these products and more incentive for them to start producing and marketing healthier products. And that's going to help, and that's going to contribute as well. So this is kind of one policy that's designed to be part of a much bigger picture. We want to also restrict promotions in supermarkets, for example, so healthier food is more available to us in supermarkets. And also make sure that we've got more services for people living with obesity to get the treatment and the psychological support they may benefit from. So I think lots of these types of policies all happening together, you know, that's what we hope is going to kind of, you know, shift the dial. But it will take time.
You're absolutely right. It's got to be part of a portfolio of measures. I mean, things like the Daily Mile, which was introduced into primary schools about a decade ago, seem to be making a big difference. What other things do you think really will change our approach to food?
I think we've got to think about kind of a life course approach as well, and think about, you know, We know that our tastes and preferences are set, you know, very early on in childhood. So what can we do to make the food that we're, you know, feeding our infants healthier? What can we do to make breastfeeding easier and more accessible for people? You know, how can we shift kind of the sugary baby food and make sure that you know, we're weaning children onto foods that are going to benefit their health in the long term? And a lot of that is making sure that, you know, parents have support and that we're funding local authorities to be able to support new parents and provide this advice. We need to make sure that we've got, you know, enough green spaces to enable children to run around and play safely, and that, you know, for adults that it's not more attractive to jump in our cars to drive short journeys when we could be walking or cycling, and finding ways to kind of encourage people to be more physically active and make it easy for everybody.
And when you saw Cristiano Ronaldo the other day removing a couple of bottles of the sponsor's Coca-Cola from the desk before a press conference and saying, "Now drink water," was there a big cheer at the Obesity Health Alliance?
We were really pleased to see Ronaldo do that. I think it was such a powerful message from somebody who's a really influential role model for children. You know, I've got an 11-year-old son who's obsessed with football. You know, he came home and that, you know, that was all he said his friends had been talking about in school that day. Because really, you know, we've got so used to seeing these brands sponsor sports. But, you know, as Ronaldo made clear, you know, elite sports stars don't drink Coca-Cola. That's not what's powering him.
Brilliant. My thanks to Caroline Carney there from the Obesity Health Alliance. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus, or Andrew is on at Tory Boy Pierce. studies using home testing to improve our understanding of how the COVID-19 pandemic is progressing across England have revealed that one of the long-term consequences of contracting the disease can be a significant loss of smell. Now, we know that not being able to taste and smell is an early warning symptom of coronavirus, but what effect does it have on your life if this lasts longer than a couple of days? With me to discuss the implications is Chrissy Kelly, who's the founder of Absent, an organisation set up to help those without a sense of smell. Now, Chrissy, some people might think that not being able to smell is just a bit of a nuisance, but what important information does smell provide us that we might otherwise take for granted?
Well, the loss of smell does affect us in all kinds of different ways that we can't really imagine if we have an intact sense of smell. And what it means is that you become disconnected from your environment, from your loved ones, from the time of day, the time of year. We get signals from smell that give us all kinds of background information about where we are, the time and place. And it really is something that's much more than just a question of being able to taste your morning cup of coffee. And of course, not being able to taste your food is the first thing that that people are aware of. But with time, over a couple of months of not being able to smell, the color slowly drains away from your life. And people are really, really suffering from this.
So this research is going on, but have you seen a big increase in numbers of people seeking advice through your organization?
Oh, absolutely. At the beginning of the pandemic, so at the end of February of 2020, we had about 1,500 people in our Facebook group. Today, we have over 50,000 in three different Facebook groups. And then altogether on our other platforms combined, we've got 65,000 people. Most of the people that are in the groups have been there for a while because they are feeling so distressed. And we offer all kinds of support. We obviously offer peer support in the forums, but we have information on our website. We have a YouTube library full of webinars with leading experts in the field, helping people manage their relationship with food, this new relationship with food, which can become really very difficult if the person develops a condition called parosmia, where everything begins to taste rancid and putrid. So we have a lot of different resources that we can offer to people, and I think this is such an important thing because it is an invisible condition. It has been historically under-recognized, and we, at Absent, we really want to try and step in and fill that gap with as much knowledge and caring support as we can offer.
Now, it may be too early to tell this, but Chrissy, do you get the sense that people will recover, or do you think that possibly it could be a permanent loss of smell and taste?
Well, I think what we're seeing now in the Facebook groups is that we are seeing people come back and say, it's been 14 months for me and I've had parosmia and smell loss and it's been horrible. And then they will say, oh, guess what? Things are starting to improve. So we are hearing we are hearing recovery stories from people who lost their sense of smell right at the beginning of the pandemic. And we know that in between, for the whether it's 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 8 months, we are also hearing lots of recovery stories. So every case is different. The true story of COVID-19 smell loss has not yet been written. But for anyone who is listening to this, who is in their 8th month or 9th month, I would say the chances are still good that you will recover. We suspect that there might be a very small percentage who don't recover. But I do think that, in the large majority of cases, there is a reason for hope. So, that's sort of my take on my unscientific take just from observing people on our forums.
And in the meantime, Chrissy, what advice would you give to someone who's experiencing this loss of smell? What can they do to alleviate the symptoms?
Right. Well, we know that there is a supportive technique called smell training, has been demonstrated in a number of studies to hasten the recovery process. Important to note that it is something that you need to do twice a day for a minimum of 4 months. anyone wishing for more information on smell training should come to the absent.org website. So that's absent with a C in the middle of the word. And we've got videos, we've got the written word, all the information that you might need to learn more about smell training. So that is something that you can do for yourself. I do think that it's very important that for people who are extremely distressed, and I would say that there are quite a few people out there who are really at their wit's end on this, that they seek other kinds of help. So, for instance, mental health support, speak to their GP. And of course, we also have people who have stopped eating, who are losing a lot of weight. Again, that is something that needs medical attention.
Really good advice. Thank you so much. Chrissy Kelly there, the founder of Absent. Now, Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls is here with the latest from the Daily Mail's sports desk. Tim, England against Germany. Are you getting nervous?
I'm less nervous than previous years. I mean, mainly due to previous experiences where the sort of inevitable, you just know it's going to happen. But look, Germany aren't as strong as they have been in previous years. I think England, we all know that there's lots of talent and ability in that squad. We've not really seen a performance so far that's got everyone off their seats. So, you know, this is the time. This is the game. Show us what you've got. I mean, the draw really opens up for them if they do get past Germany. So I think they've just got to go for it. Be positive. Go on the front foot. And with, you know, some fantastic young players, you know, hopefully Harry Kane will fire into life. And, you know, the one sort of surprising aspect has been sort of how solid we've been at the back, which nobody was really expecting going into the tournament. We were so much focused on all our attacking talent. And, you know, that gives me real hope for that match. But, you know, it's Germany, it's knockout match. They've got some very good players, despite, you know, their slightly disappointing group stage where they just sort of scraped through, really. But nervous, no. I come back to me on Monday and I may give you a different answer.
It's the hope that kills you. You know that, Tim. Listen, before we get to Tuesday's game, we've got the other last 16 Euro matches, including Wales against Denmark. Now, poor old Wales have found themselves the team that everyone wants to see lose.
I know. It's a complete role reversal from 5 years ago, obviously, when they had that incredible run to the semi-finals, which was, you know, beyond anybody's wildest expectations. But, of course, they're coming up against the Danes, which is, you know, everybody's second team for this tournament after what happened to Christian Eriksen in the first match against Finland. They were, you know, we all know how difficult that was for them to end up playing that game a few hours later. I thought they were excellent against Belgium and perhaps a little unfortunate to lose that game. But their performance against Russia was absolutely magnificent. The support they were getting in Copenhagen was fantastic. And they've got some good players. You know, they've got a very good goalkeeper in Kasper Schmeichel. Christensen at the back has obviously just won the Champions League with Chelsea. Højbjerg's done well, the Spurs midfielder. So, you know, they are a good side, even without Eriksen, who is their chief creative talent. But it's a difficult situation for Wales to be in because, you know, they're the smallest country by population left in the tournament. And, you know, normally everybody would be, there'd be the underdogs and everybody would be getting behind them. But just because of the sort of the whole incredible emotion around Denmark at the moment, everybody's going to be wanting Denmark, unless, of course, you're from Wales. So they're going to have, you know, that's going to be a challenge for them. But I have to say, Wales have impressed me in this tournament so far. I don't think we had huge expectations for them. Certainly, nobody thought they were going to replicate what they did 5 years ago. But they've really impressed me. And, you know, they're a little bit unfortunate, I thought, against Italy. They lost that game 1-0 when they were down to 10 men. And, you know, they've got a chance. Denmark, you know, they can beat Denmark. There's no denying that. But it's going to be a very emotional evening in Amsterdam. But obviously Denmark being away, you know, they're not playing in Copenhagen now where their support, the crowd was so important for them. I think it's a 50-50 game, to be honest. I think Wales can win that. I really do. But it's they've got to get past all that emotion and forget about the fact that everybody's going to be willing the Danes to win, I'm afraid.
Now, there's some good news this week. Well, great news, actually. There's going to be 140,000 spectators every day at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone next month. So there's going to be 60,000 at the Euros final at Wembley. But there's always a drawback here. There's only 10,000 people being allowed tomorrow at Twickenham for the Rugby Premiership final. Is rugby being unfairly penalised here, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure if they're being unfairly penalised, but they're certainly, something doesn't quite add up to me. you know, looking at it, why aren't more people going into Twickenham? We're going to have 50% capacity at Wimbledon next week. We've already seen crowds at Ascot. We've already seen crowds at Wembley. As you say, there's going to be 60,000 going forward at Wembley, and there's going to be huge numbers at Silverstone. So why can't more people go to Twickenham? You know, we saw 18,000 at Edgbaston a couple of weeks ago for the England-New Zealand test. So, you know, like so many things in life at the moment, I'm afraid that there's not much consistency. And when you start pulling at the thread, lots of things don't make sense. I can understand why rugby and rugby fans are feeling hard done by, because, you know, it's the showpiece occasion of the season. They really could get many more than 10,000 in Twickenham, you know, safely. I'm sure there's no doubt about that. So I think they're well within their rights to feel that they're being unfairly treated. Whether they're actually being penalised or not, I'm not sure. But it doesn't seem right. But, you know, what can you do at the moment? I'm afraid people just are having to follow, you know, the rules that they're being, or that are set out for them. And, you know, rugby doesn't want to rock the boat. They want to prove that they can get the game on and safely, and 10,000 in and out, no problem. But there should be more people at Twickenham. It's an 80,000 capacity stadium.
Absolutely right. Thank you very much, Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nichols. Probably there is one thing guaranteed to annoy people: mispronouncing words like probably. According to a study involving 2,000 participants published this week, 35% of respondents listed pacifically, as when the word should be pronounced specifically, obviously, as the most annoying verbal error. So why is it about pronunciation that's more likely to get up people's noses than a PCR test swab? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Jane Setter, who's Professor of Phonetics at the University of Reading and co-editor of the 18th edition of the Cambridge English Pronouncing Dictionary, to tell us more. I hope I said that right, Jane.
Pronouncing Dictionary.
As an expert in pronunciation, how do you feel when you hear someone ordering an espresso?
Well, as an expert in pronunciation, I'm just interested to note the variation that's going on, quite frankly, because as linguists, we're interested in what people are doing with language and how they're using it. We're not interested in criticising people about their language.
The survey said that pacifically was the most annoying thing. Why do you think that is? What particularly about that word annoys people?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, clearly there is a word which is pacific, which is very different from specific. The meaning is very different. I can't really account for why people would say pacifically rather than specifically, other than we have this other word which is quite similar, and it may have arisen through things, people saying something like it's specifically, then, you know, you could hear it's pacifically rather than it's specifically. It's possibly that. Why it annoys people, I don't know, because it doesn't annoy me. I just find it interesting that people are doing it.
You've said you try and keep neutral, try and rise above annoyance when you're going to. But have you noticed that words are increasingly being mispronounced? If that is the right word, you might say it isn't the right word. It's just a different way of saying it. But have you noticed that the language is changing more rapidly than it used to?
I think that's the thing. Language is changing, and language does change, and it's a continual process. This is not something that you can stop. We are not speaking now like people in the Elizabethan period or in the period of Chaucer or in the Old English period. We're not speaking like that. And you wouldn't expect that, because language does change. And there have been a number of surveys done comparing language data that was collected in the 1950s with language data that's been collected more recently, and you can see that there are interesting differences in the way that people are producing language. And we can actually attribute this in many ways to social differences. The fact that people are now moving around the country a lot more than they did in the 1950s, for example, meeting others, hearing different ways that people say things. But with a word like espresso, for example, we have a word express in English. Express and espresso are actually from the same root. It means pressed out. So it's the same word, basically. But, you know, if you hear somebody saying, I'll have an espresso, and you've never heard it before, then you're likely to, by analogy, hear the word espresso, even if
that's not exactly what they said, because we have this word express. So and actually I'm reliably informed in French, for example, that it is espresso, not espresso. So, you know, we're kind of grumbling about something that, that doesn't really make an awful lot of difference. I think the reason that we are more likely to say espresso, but we're not going to get other kinds of coffee wrong, if you like, things like macchiato, for example, we just don't have anything in the language like macchiato. So we're not likely to confuse that with another word, which is very close to it. So that could be one of the reasons why we're seeing this with espresso, but not with that one. But yeah, I mean, language just changes all the time. And if it didn't, I think we'd have to say that there was something very, very strange going on.
Yeah, language does change, you're right. But are there any words today that we consider, as it were, correctly pronounced that actually started as mispronunciations?
Oh, now that's a question I could have done with some preparation for. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. I mean, there are bound to be. But off the top of my head, I can't think of any. But we certainly do get people meddling with language. So, for example, in the Renaissance period, scholars thought that English should look more like Latin and Greek. So they added in letters. So one very well-known example is the word debt, which doesn't have a B in it. We don't say a B, but this was added. And we also get spelling pronunciations of things. Again, it's probably because you're not familiar with a word, but something that I've written about, for example, is the word spelled L-I-D-O. I grew up in Thanet, and we had Margate Lido, and there's Tooting Beck Lido. But the original word is from Italian, and it's Lido. But if you've never seen that, then you'll say it according to the way that the word is written down. And for spelling rules for English, it's Lido. But we are now finding that some more kind of are referring to themselves as Lidos rather than Lidos. So that's quite interesting and could be a kind of an issue to do with how different uses of language attracts different social groups.
And I've noticed that you've not mentioned anything about regional accents, you know, grass instead of grass.
Well, no, but this isn't talking about this. The specific thing that's come up in the news recently isn't talking about regional accents. It's talking about people being unhappy about fairly common words that would be similar in a number of accents, like probably, for example, people saying probably or probably or something like that. In rapid speech, you're likely to get that because it's a word that's very, very commonly used. And we do tend to miss sounds out in rapid speech if it's a very, very common word, which isn't contributing an awful lot to the meaning. So, but from a regional point of view, we have such a wide range of different accents in the British Isles, and a lot of it is to do with identity, tribalism to some extent, and the fact that we really didn't move around very much until the middle of the last century after the Second World War, when there were better roads, transport infrastructure was much better, people travelled around a lot more for work and so on. So we had communities that stayed in the same place for a very long period of time, hundreds of years, and so accents develop there, and you do get these very tight-knit groups who identify through their accents. And sadly, there is accent prejudice in the UK against certain accents. People find certain accents ugly, for example, or they find certain accents friendly or funny because of stereotyping that we have through the media.
Thanks very much for that very specific answer. I'll let you go and have an espresso. That was Professor Jane Setter of the University of Reading. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. It's also the last time you'll be hearing from me. Next week at 5 p.m, the great Andrew Pearce returns to the hot seat, bringing you more of the stories that matter. I'm Jim White, and this has been great fun. Thanks to Chelsea, Julia and Rob for making it all work so smoothly. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.